Recently, I became aware of and joined a new network of scholars called the Solar Network. Solar, S-O-L-A-R, for scholars of literature and religion. And this network got me thinking about a range of networks or interactions cutting across the worlds of faith and intellect, like literature and religion, or universities and their communities, or theology and practice, or individuals and their sense of the divine.
We are relating our faith to all of the aspects of our life, including scholarship, and also driven by the conviction that Christian faith has a lot to say to these human endeavors, including my own work of in literature and the literary imagination.
I'm speaking today with the Reverend Dr. David Mahan. He is executive director of the Rivendell Center for Theology and the Arts and a campus minister at Yale University. One of the creators of the Solar Network, David is also a scholar of theopoetics, which sits at the intersection of theology and literature. What is more, David is a thoughtful commentator on the variety of ways we imagine faith in the modern world, making him a great conversation partner for this podcast. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. David Mahan, thank you for joining us today on the Faith and Imagination podcast.
It's great to be here, Matt. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, it's a privilege to have you here. You recently helped create a network for scholars of literature and religion, and that idea of the network captures why I thought you'd be such a great guest, because there are some very interesting branches to your work, and I'm wondering how they connect. So, for example, you have a scholarly interest in theopoetics, or the intersection of theology and literature. You work as executive director of the Rivendell Center for Theology and the Arts at Yale, which, per its mission statement, I'm quoting here from that statement, seeks to examine and advance the contribution of a Christian vision of life to human flourishing and the common good within the academy and contemporary culture. And then you've worked for more than two decades as a campus minister at Yale. For you, these areas, you know, your areas of specialization as a scholar and your work as a director at the Rivendell Center and your work as a campus minister, are these separate areas, or do you imagine them really as deeply integrated, as the metaphor of a network might suggest?
Yeah, deeply integrated. In fact, the impulse for the whole is very mission-driven by a deep conviction that Christian faith has something important to say, always, but to our particular cultural moment. And that message can tend to get a little bit thin. And yet the gospel itself is what we call thick. That is, it's a vision for all of life. And so any sort of human undertaking or endeavor falls within the purview of a gospel concern, so to speak. So I think it's vitally important that we have that kind of integrity, to use the same kind of word, where we are relating our faith to all of the aspects of our life, including scholarship. And also driven by the conviction that Christian faith has a lot to say to these human endeavors, including my own work of in literature and the literary imagination. But I think too, there's that mission-mindedness, if you want to call it that, always provides motivation and impulse that is important to any of the work that I do, whether that work involves mentoring students or faculty personally, or teaching classes, or writing academic articles. It's all part of that same kind of motivation to hold forth a robust vision of Christian faith.
That's nice. That resonates with me. BYU's got a religious mission behind its education. And it's one that has become very important to me personally over the years, which is one reason why I really admire the work that you do there, David, at Yale. Our podcast here is titled Faith and Imagination. And after it occurred to me to engage you in conversation. Okay, I saw on a webpage of the Rivendell Center a passage you cite from the landmark book Theopoetic by Amos Wilder, and mm-hmm. you cite the line, it's at the very top, and it's from, he's actually quoting himself in a volume of poems. It's just a simple sentence. It is at the level of imagination that the fateful issues of our new world experience must first be mastered. And I thought, you know, how fortuitous that we felt inclined to talk with David, that he agreed to talk with us. I wonder if I could ask you how you imagine the role of faith in your work.
Well, again, in thinking of my faith as a vision for all of life, everything falls within it. I think the imagination is vitally important, always has been. Even though the church writ large has sometimes held the imagination or works of the imagination with suspicion, it's clear that there are things we simply can't even do as humans, including an intimate connection with God without the imagination. And of course, Christian scriptures themselves are full with imaginative forms and imaginative appeals. And so I think it's a vital faculty, but it's a vital faculty to renewal in every age and culture. The church always has to reimagine its witness within its particular historical moment or cultural setting. And so the tools that the imagination gives us for doing that are vitally important. There's a theologian from Cambridge I worked with when I did my PhD there, David Ford, who talks about the ways that works of art, for example, tutor us or engage us in the apprenticeship of thinking carefully about our faith and the various expressions of our faith. And so to me, it's not a reach at all. So vitally important to my faith, vitally important to human flourishing.
Fantastic. I'm curious, you said something that you said many things there that resonate with me, but something that you said I want to follow up on, that imagination's important to the renewal of the church. How frequently must the church renew itself through these acts of imagination? Is it the kind of thing where it's a weekly basis, a daily basis, or is it kind of more by eras? And if it's the latter, would you say that our current era is one that requires especially a sense of renewal?
I do. In my book, An Unexpected Light, I conclude with the phrase, a missiology of the imagination, where the work that I do in that book and my own conviction is that the imagination is vital to any acts of renewal, but the church is constantly in the process of renewing itself. In a culture like ours, which is undergoing major changes on a regular basis, how do we keep up with that? Coupled with the diminishment of biblical literacy and understanding of the faith, not just on the part of those who don't believe, but those who do believe, I think the imagination is even more prominent in its importance for renewal.
Yeah, great. I guess on the subject, well, I want to talk to you in a minute about your work in theopoetics, which is expressly about, you know, sort of this intersection of faith and imagination in really dynamic ways. One thing you've done, though, before I get there, one thing you've done recently that seems to work toward renewal in kind of a practical way, but there are interesting implications from it, is the creation of this solar network, this for scholars of literature and religion. And it arose as an effort, at least on the website, to link students studying religion and literature to potential graduate programs and advisors. What prompted you to identify this as a particular need?
Yeah. Well, two things. One, just my own work with students who frequently are pursuing, in my case, I work with graduate students, so pursuing doctoral programs and not knowing who's out there. Who is working at the intersection of literature and religion who might be sympathetic to my own interests? How can I find them and connect with them and see if they would become suitable supervisors? And so it was a pastoral concern for my students to help them connect with people and programs that were going to facilitate that. because religion can still be held suspect, I'm thinking of literature departments, it's important to find someone who's sympathetic at least to that intersection of faith and literature. But also, I also felt it was vitally important to be intentional in creating these networks. There's remarkable work being done in literature and religion, has been for decades. The body of work is growing constantly. We need more opportunities to talk with each other, to collaborate, to think about the challenges that we want to take on in our field that give us opportunity to bring our faith to bear, so to speak, on our work. And so in addition to connecting students with those potential advisors or supervisors, which is really shepherding the next generation of scholars, it's creating another tool, another vehicle for us to be in conversation with each other.
Exactly right. I signed up myself.
Yeah, great.
You know, and I've perused the website. It's nicely done, and it's a great resource. So thank you very much for doing that. If you had created the network a decade ago, or maybe a decade later, I'm curious if you think it would be different in any substantive way. I'm not asking only here about state of technology, what we can and can't do.
Sure,
you know, with I really, it's more about the state of the field of literature and religion. You know, are there new needs that students have or that scholars have now that strike you as being especially important in the creation of this kind of a network?
Yeah. So I this relates to your earlier question about whether renewal is needed constantly. We face new challenges. I'm thinking about American society, although this is true in societies around the world, where we have new challenges, new issues rising to the surface. And Christians, including Christians or scholars working in religion and literature, need to think about the impact of those issues on their field. So I don't know that it would change in the sense that we want to be tapped into those key issues, but certainly the issues are changing, and we need to formulate a continuing response to it. I do think there is a sense of crisis around the kinds of faith commitments that younger people have. Very disenchanted with the state of the church. Again, I'm thinking of an American context, and perhaps especially maybe a white evangelical context, for example, or a mainline denominational context, where they don't feel like their faith is speaking to them or to the issues of the age. And so I think it's important for that reason today, maybe even felt more acutely than it did before. But I also think that the burgeoning amount of scholarship in literature and religion changes the circumstances of the Solar Network today. There's just a lot more work being done, and even possibly an exponential growth in the work. And that means the multiplication of scholars who are working in that field, which only gives more urgency to doing the Solar Network now, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of scholars around the world working at that intersection.
Oh, which is great. That's very exciting. Something you said, I want to pick up on that here a minute ago. You talked about kind of this being kind of in some ways a trying moment for Christianity across a number of different denominations, that young people in particular don't find their needs met often inside of organized religion, or they express, you know, and the whole, I'm thinking about the emergence of the spiritual but not religious movement. You know, one of the ways that's been reflected in scholarship is through the interest in, you know, post-secularity. And there are some people who take that very, as an expression of a return to religion. Others take it, you know, as being about not so much religion as something evocatively spiritual that can't be confined to religion. Do you come down on one side or the other of the post-secular? Does it resonate for you in both those registers, religious and non-religious? Or does literature and religion encompass both ends of that? Or is it really a narrower kind of feel for those who really want to make the connection to religion explicit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, any interest in religion or the religious in my field is welcome. And of course, the famous turn to religion has been evolving for decades already. Post-secularism is an interesting opportunity. Of course, it started with sociology, but many scholars, including literary scholars, including scholars of religion and literature, have taken it up as an opportunity. And I think one thing that it does do is to take religion seriously in ways that maybe it hasn't been. Not necessarily defined wholly against secularism, whatever we mean by that, but as a viable and important feature of human life and existence, that works of literature, novels, short fiction, poetry, all champion in their effect. So I think that new opportunity is important for us to seize. And I think, you know, the it's a very broad tent. That said, scholars, especially those who are engaging post-secularism, recognize that that doesn't mean there is a renewed interest in, for example, confessional faith. Even hostility to that may abide. And so the work that scholars who have that kind of a faith, even as they are seizing the opportunities that a post-secular climate might open up, are going to have to work hard to demonstrate why their more traditional faith understanding still is important and still offers a viable vision of life.
That's a very thoughtful observation, David. Thank you for that. I wonder if we can, in thinking about that vision of life, that viable vision of life, how faith provides it, if we can turn to some of your work in theopoetics and your vision kind of for what that means. It's such an interesting kind of conjunction of interest there, theopoetics, kind of that intersection of theology and usually poetry, but can more broadly mean literature. I'm curious to ask you at the beginning whether you're drawn to poetry for the same reason that you're drawn to theology. You know, what for you is the relationship between those two things?
Well, I love language, and I love imaginative works of literature that appreciate what language is. There's another theologian I worked with who speaks of the long discipline in learning how to speak. Mm. And I think that cuts across theologically specific or literary specific kinds of disciplines. And so that I'm drawn to that conjunction for that reason, as well as my personal convictions about the importance of the imagination. I should say, Matt, that theopoetics itself has undergone some changes. So we use it generally as the intersection of theology and literature. What began as more of an effort to renew theological language that you find with people like Amos Wilder, Stanley Hopper, et cetera, has really become more an effort to revise or even replace traditional forms of theological discourse, and is heavily invested in critical theory and more political than when it began. So I just want to make that theopoetics is now its own subfield.
Yeah.
For me, I think I am a person of the book, so to speak. And not only is language the site of articulating what we mean when we say we have God, what we even mean by God, but is the site for extraordinary exploration of our existence under God. I think the Bible is that. Reading the Bible is as much as anything as the inspiration for my own work in theopoetics, to use that term more broadly, as any other source. But I love what language does. I love when I'm reading novelists and poets who are really gifted and even self-conscious about language, its potentiality, its ambiguities. I think it puts us in a space where we are reflecting on things that are important to us, but in ways that are facilitated with language that could not be facilitated otherwise. So, you know, rational discourse is important to theology. It's important to every field of inquiry, but other kinds of discourses. And so my classes, I describe as efforts to read literature theologically. So we have that context of theology, but we are looking to see what is literature doing in a way that has what the biblical scholar Robert Alter called peculiar advantages. And so I love to be in that space where I am discovering and appreciating the peculiar advantages that the literary brings to our contemplation of our existence, but to theology specifically as well.
Nice. So I'm curious how broadly then you interpret the affordances of theopoetics. So are your interests primarily in writers, you know, poets and others, novelists, et cetera, whose work addresses some facet of theology expressly? What about poets, you know, or other writers who don't address theology per se, but whose work has a distinctively spiritual orientation or quality, right? How broadly, you think, can theopoetics go?
Very broadly. In fact, there's, and I tell my students the same thing, I don't read any literature that for me doesn't somehow interact with religious kinds of questions, at least, if not coming out of a faith perspective. And so my syllabi for my classes are very diverse. I did a class this past fall on literature of trauma, and we were reading literature from people of faith. We were reading literature from atheists. We were reading literature out of Jewish spirituality, Native American spirituality, African American and Black experience, global experience. You know, so I love to introduce my students to literature that is doing interesting work that engages the kinds of questions we might care about as people of faith, but from a very fresh and different perspective. I find that very generative.
I love that.
Broad tent.
Yeah, I love that. I myself teach a course every couple of years in my department called Literature and Spiritual Experience. It takes a lot of the same approach, and it finds a lot of possibility and a lot of insight often in people who are not themselves religious, but who are trying to put their finger on impulses that have a profoundly religious background. I mean, so that religion becomes a really great way to explain why certain writers care so deeply about certain kinds of things.
Well, and I find that, I mean, I get students who are atheists, and I know they are because they announce it in the class. And I revel in the opportunity to, if nothing else, at least give them a different angle of vision on what religion is about that is exposed, again, not just through self-consciously religious authors, but authors who are grappling with these questions. You know, it's interesting, man. Another colleague of mine who did this panel with me on Christian poetics a couple of years ago, he made an important observation. He said, even if literary critics or literary scholars may have marginalized the religious or made it idiosyncratic, writers have never done that. If you read the literature, again, I'm thinking of in an American context of the last 100 years, they are obsessed with religious questions, even if they're hostile to religion. So I'm doing a class on faith, doubt, and redemption this semester, and we're reading James Baldwin, we're reading Don DeLillo, we're reading Leslie Marmon's Silk Road Ceremony. You know, so that interest in the religious has never really departed from the writerly vision that we find in the literatures of the last 100 years.
Those are courses, David, I would love to take. So, you know, alas, I'm kind of far away where I'm located.
But
what you say resonates a lot. We're in this is the Faith and Imagination podcast. Here in our Humanities Center, we have a Faith and Imagination lecture series. And our very first guest, a guy named Matthew Mutter, who'd written a book called Restless Secularism. It's all about...
I love Matthew's book. He did a panel for us. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Huh? And it's all about how writers that would otherwise would be, you know, atheists are trying to figure out how to get rid of the questions of religion and God and theology, and they find that it's very difficult to do. Which it's a wonderful yeah. book. It's beautifully nuanced and complex.
And there is a work, you know, where Matthew distinguishes what kind of an interest in religion we are finding in post-secularism, and is very careful to make the distinction I was making earlier. That doesn't mean an interest in traditional faith. In fact, it's very likely not the case. So I think Matthew's work and the works of many others encourage us to be, you know, to have a broad tent about the literatures that we're reading with a religious interest.
That's great. One of your interests in theopoetics is this idea of a Christian poetics, which I noticed was one of the initiatives that the Rivendell Center had taken up. Can you explain what that project on Christian poetics is about?
Yeah, so some of it obviously is an effort to reignite the presence of Christian voices in literary studies, but not in a way that's territorial, not in a way that's demanding a seat at the table, but with the conviction that when we bring such a vision of life to any work we do, it is going to make it better and make it flourish. And so the impulse of it is the onus placed upon Christian scholars to demonstrate the contribution that Christian faith makes to literary studies, to show through the richness of those sources how much better literary studies are. And I'm not just talking about studying the Divine Comedy or Paradise Lost or the novels of Walker Percy or the short fiction of Flannery O'Connor, but Christianity brings distinctive contributions to the field that would really deprive the field of being fuller and richer if those voices were not present. And so there's a great deal of emphasis, not on defining it in a way that systematizes what we mean by Christian poetics, but one that acknowledges and looks for the rich resources that Christian faith brings to the study of literature. And as I say, to demonstrate that enriching contribution that faith makes. Now that said, Matt, I actually couldn't, if somebody asked me today, what do you mean by Christian poetics? I would say, I don't know.
That's a great answer.
I find myself in a galaxy of issues and concerns. So when I did this panel on shaping a Christian poetics for the 21st century at the conference you had mentioned a few years back, And I said, if I were to do this same panel 10 years from now, I would still call it Shaping a Christian Poetics for the 21st Century. So I'm just trying to engage the process in a very intentional and a very constructive way.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. I think that approaching it always open-ended with some kind of burden on explaining the affordances, phenomenological or theoretical, conceptual, right, of what this kind of poetics would bring. I think that's very smart as an approach. It's an inspiring project. And there's so much that, as you point out, Christianity and its history can bring to literature. I'm wondering also what literature brings to those who are not academics. You know, you're the director, executive director of the Rivendell Center for Theology and the Arts, and so you encounter a lot of really exciting intellectual work. I'm wondering whether you see a connection between these intellectual projects on the one hand, and on the other hand, the lives of Yale students or members of the New Haven community.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things I think that benefit. And again, I get students in my classes who aren't part of the Divinity School and aren't part of my ministry on campus. And it provides a new entry point for them to think creatively, think in fresh ways about even the possibility that maybe religious faith has something to say to me personally. And so I, on the other hand, I'm very open about my faith with my faculty, friends, and colleagues, and with students. I try to be transparent with them. And but when they learn that I'm very interested, invested in the study of literature, we immediately find a point of contact. They're not going to show up at one of my ministry events. They're not going to show up at my church, maybe. But we've got a common space that we can inhabit together around a work of the imagination that both of us find inspiring. So often it's the case people don't want to go there because there is no entry point. Or somebody who doesn't have faith think they need to jump through my hoops in order to have a meaningful conversation with me about their questions or whatever. So having that work of literature in the middle of the table gives both of us access to a conversation we might not have otherwise.
Do you think, I guess with that in mind, do you think that the intellectual work that has kind of crossover spiritual value, I'll call it, right, where it can speak to different audiences, different groups, and whether it creates some kind of affirmative place of response in the middle. Do you think that that kind of crossover intellectual work is born with that crossover potential in mind, or does that kind of potential, does it happen more fortuitously or even providentially?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, this goes back to your question about the whole Christian Poetics Initiative. I do think we need to be intentional. And I think if you are a person of faith who thinks your faith has something to say to your age and society, you're the one who has to move towards them and find ways to connect. So the biblical image is being ambassadors. So you don't show up and claim the territory. You show up as a person who wants to, you know, to engage, to learn as much about the other culture as whatever it is that you bring to that setting yourself. And so I think that it's important that you're consciously thinking about how to do that. So again, there's a lot of work going on with religion and literature. We're not real intentional about collaborating on this and say, gosh, how could this affect the entire discourse of literary studies? That's going to take some intentionality. So I don't want to overplan. I don't want to overdetermine. And especially when you've got a very unmanageable category like Christian poetics that would only foreclose a lot of the potential and possibility. But I think you've got to get out there and say, let's consciously work on this together. And so this is where the Solar Network has, you know, the second element, which is collaboration. How can we encourage collaboration? And a lot of people are actually doing that. The Conference on Christianity Literature, for example, has been doing that for decades now. So we're participating in an ongoing intentional strategy as sort of latecomers to that. But I do think we need to bring intentionality to the effort. And again, we do that on behalf of our colleagues and our students, because we're the ones who have to demonstrate the viability of what we're talking about. So it's not just, again, so that we can feel good about our own perspective or we can have our own seat at the table, but it's to enrich everybody's lives through the study of literature as faith interacts with that.
It's a great vision, David. It really is. Thank you. I wonder if on that subject of intentionality, I can ask you a couple questions about your work in campus ministry. I'm wondering about whether you think that your work as a serious scholar of literature has made you a better campus minister, and conversely, whether your work in campus ministry makes you a different scholar and perhaps a better one.
Yeah. A great question. It definitely enhances my ministry, but it also refocuses my ministry. So much of the mentoring that I do is with, young scholars of literature and religion, the students I teach in my classes, students who might get involved in activities, not only of the Rivendell Center for Theology and the Art, but the Rivendell Institute, which is sort of the umbrella organization that features spiritual formation opportunities, et cetera. So it also brings credibility, you know, that I as a scholar bring a different kind of credibility to ministry that somebody who is not doing scholarship in a university context may not have, or not have in the same way. And that I can be colleagues, that I can be a colleague with other faculty is very significant. Again, it gives me the opportunity to be in conversations I might not have opportunities to otherwise. So it definitely works in that direction. What the ministry context does for my scholarship is what I said earlier. It gives it a mission mindfulness. Why do I think this is important? Is this related to a larger vision of life? It's not an end in itself. It serves a higher calling, not just a higher calling that I've chosen to adopt, but a higher calling that people of Christian faith just have in the world. And so it becomes a particular way of expressing that calling, but it's meaningful because it's connected to that larger vision. So for me, it has really shaped my own discipleship of myself, as well as the kind of mentoring I might do with others.
Do you think that calling, that calling for Christians has got a perpetual quality to it, right? But it also, as you mentioned earlier in talking about renewal, it can be, people can be called to do slightly different things, you know, from different stages of life or different eras. I'm going back to what you said earlier about a lot of the concerns about the deterioration of trust in faith communities on the part of especially people our students' ages. Do you find that your work in literature gives you a way to move people that would otherwise not be available to you, that literature is that shared space, even for those who want to have religious faith, but just have a hard time mustering it?
Yeah, I think so. And again, it provides entry points that might not otherwise exist. So if I want to open my Bible with you, you might find that very intimidating or off-putting, even if you're a person of faith. If I open a novel with you, that gets at some of the same kinds of issues that I think, you know, we want to engage, you may feel safer to approach it from, you know, that, you know, that direction or that path. So that's an obvious advantage. It's a non-religious way of getting at important religious discussions. But I'm deeply committed to scripture and to historic understandings of scripture and the importance of that. So making scripture itself more accessible by drawing upon my literary scholarship as a reader of the Bible also creates fresh new opportunity to re-engage our scriptures that might not otherwise happen if I didn't bring those sensibilities to that effort with somebody.
Nice. Just a plug here for your essay that you published in Christianity and Literature last year in a special issue guest edited by my BYU colleague, Kimberly Johnson, where you make a really, I think, compelling case that poetry can do serious theological work and that poems elicit from readers something like faithful reading. And you show through three poets how that happens, how poetry and scripture read side by side can really open each other up in ways that otherwise wouldn't be available. I thought that was a really elegant and convincing case you make there, David.
Yeah. So that I think you mean the piece Revised Versions, and it points to an earlier question, Matt, that you raised about, as you say, about renewal, but what literature brings to theological reflection. And with or without the contingencies of our own particular age and moment, that kind of refreshment needs to happen all the time. And I am thrilled when I find somebody opening up scripture poetically in a way that I just would not see otherwise. And so I think poets are, not only are they deeply invested in language, which of course scripture is, but they have a capacity to turn what I call with my students turning the prism and exposing a new refraction that doesn't undermine the text, although it may subvert some of the expectations we used to bring to the text, or even a ho-hum kind of attitude, because I've heard that over and over again. It's like, wow, here's a poet's vision on that text, and suddenly it comes alive for me again. And again, that finds its way all the way into the mentoring work that I do in a more specific direct ministry context.
Terrific. We are about at the end of our time for our conversation. I've got one more question for you. I'm interested to know what your advice would be to students who are interested in pursuing literature and religion. And would the advice that you gave, would it lean more toward the professional side? Here's how you do it if you want to do it. Or would it lean more toward the personal side? Here's who you need to be if you want to do it.
Yeah, another great question. I mean, the market pressures right now for potential academics are acute. You know, we are looking at a crisis of the future of liberal arts in this country and the future of the humanities, and trying to get work in that market is extremely difficult. So I feel it's important that I help students to have eyes wide open. But I'll tell you what I told a former student of mine who got into a very prominent PhD in English program, who was thinking of leaving it and going to law school because he wanted to be able to support his family. And I said, look, I totally get that, and I sympathize with it, but you have got to answer the question, what did God make you to do? And I know you. I know you love literature. I know that there is nothing that excites you more than that. And surely those are at least some important indicators of a calling. So there's that word again. So I definitely try to acknowledge the professional realities and professional requirements. But ultimately, I make it personal. You know, what is God calling you to do? Even if you don't become a tenured professor as a scholar of literature and religion, if you love that work, God will find a place for that in your life. And that could look any number of different ways. I many of the students I work with at Yale Divinity School are going into the ministry. You know, and I feel like I am equipping them for the work of the ministry by exposing them to this intersection of literature and religion, that's really going to benefit them as readers, as preachers, as mentors, etc. So there could be a lot of outcomes to that kind of work, not just an academic position. So that's another facet of it, that, you know, it's both professional and personal.
This has been such a great conversation, David. I applaud the excellent work you're doing and so many facets of your work out there at Yale. I'm grateful for the work you're doing as a scholar of literature and religion. So thank you for that work generally, and thank you especially today for talking with me on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Matt. Again, it's a privilege, and I love to have these opportunities. Thanks for the work that you guys all do out there as well. It's much appreciated.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.